Welcome to Retrospective Radio. I'm Jason Mann, and with me today is Seth Roy. And we're starting something new here at Retrospective. We're starting the Main Event Project. And what that is we're going to talk about the main events of every pay-per-view from the every major pay-per-view in the United States from the beginning of time. And we're going to start with Starrcade 83, which wasn't technically a pay-per-view, but we gets to be grandfathered in since it's an important event and since the later Starrcades, of course, were important pay-per-views. So we'll start with that. Seth, how are you doing today?
I am doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. All right. Well, it begins with Harley Race winning the NWA title on June 10th, 1983, which ended Flair's 21-month reign. And he won it in St. Louis on, was a situation, it was like a double pinfall where Flair was on the bottom with his shoulders down and Race was on top of him with his shoulders down, sort of in a German suplex position, but laying down. And then Race ended up getting his shoulder up after two. And winning the title there. So, funny thing is that, you know, Flair was champion, like I said, for 21 months. And it's interesting how, like, in later interviews, he minimizes that first reign. Like, you know, he talks about, like, it was the second reign that really established him as NWA champion. And you almost think, based on how he talks about it, it was, like, a very short transitional reign when, you know, he really was, you know, the guy for 21 months. It's just, you know, interesting his perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. I know on the Starrcade DVD came out a couple years ago, in the interview leading up to the Harley Race match, you know, the interview 25 years later, he talks about how it was one of the greatest nights of his wrestling career, and he didn't exactly at that in this interview say, you know, really established me, but it, you know, sort of made the point that, yes, it was his second reign, but it was such a monumental win, and maybe that was because it was on a show billed as big as Starrcade.
Definitely his first win, I think, which I think came against Dusty Rhodes in Kansas City. Wasn't really, you know, wasn't his home territory. It wasn't really a crowd that knew him well. Wasn't really a very big crowd. You know, just wasn't. I can definitely see the dynamics of that being, you know, far less exciting than, you know, with the second reign. But still, it's just, you know, interesting how perceptions of things can be.
Right. It's not like he had Kane's one-day reign in 1998.
Right, exactly, yeah. Interesting thing, you know, that we both listened to the Larry Matisick interviews, you know, mm-hmm. talking about the St. Louis territory. And, you know, Larry Matisick, for those who don't know, he was a longtime announcer and for that territory, and also worked behind the scenes and was sort of, you know, he was the booker for a while and a, you know, major force in that office. And by 83, he had split with the people who were running it, and they were having a promotional war there. And the Race title change there, I guess, was meant to be a shot in that war, which he found amusing because that would only require Race to travel a lot instead of, you know, work that St. Louis territory where he was, that was near his home base of Kansas City and where he was a major star. But the major angle that led to this match was a match in Mid-Atlantic on television between Flair and Race, and it was August 31st, 1983, so a little more than 2 months after the title change. And it's a really, really good match between Flair and Race. In fact, some people even consider it better than the Starrcade match. And the finish comes with Flair having Race in the figure four, and Bob Orton and Dick Slater both interfere. Slater interferes first, and then Bob Orton comes in later, and then they combine to give Flair a spike pile driver and, you know, wrench his neck and injure it. And then they run away, and Piper and Roddy Piper and Wahoo McDaniel come out to check on Flair. And I thought a couple things I thought were interesting about this for the first time that I noticed that the fan reaction to it. It wasn't like they were really, really like booing the heels. It was like, you know, like a like stunned silence, like, you know, like, oh, you know, like Flair's really hurt. You know, what's going on here, you know, which I thought was a very cool and interesting crowd reaction.
Now that their attack was set up by a promo. I'm not sure how far before the promo was a bounty that Harley Race put on Ric Flair.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
$25,000.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Basically. Yeah. I mean, you know, Flair, of course, wanted the title back, and Race, you know, felt like, you know, Flair was a thorn in his side. So it's interesting the, you know, the bounty angle we've seen here or there, and you know, it was, you know, put to very effective use here. I mean, definitely that, you know, that crowd, you know, really, you know, it, I mean, they were, you know, Flair was already their hometown guy, so they're already behind him, but it really, you know, added some emotional stakes to this feud. It was, you know, a great angle, and I really like the they do, and they go, like, they go into the locker room afterward and interview Race and Orton and Slater. Race gives them the cash, and, you know, the, and Jim Crockett screaming that they're, you know, that they're done there, and, you know, like, you know, Orton and Slater are, you know, laughing, like, you know, like you know, they've done something evil, and they're, you know, bragging about it. It's just, it's really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, following that, Flair decides to retire due to injuries from the attack. But this retirement doesn't last long. In fact, he comes back and he attacks Orton and Slater with a bat on television, and then, you know, gives a really great promo.
Yeah, it was a great promo.
Yeah, and, you know, screaming that's only just begun, and that he's going to, you know, he's going to get his vengeance on, you know, on Orton and Slater, but especially Race. And the last major thing was they held a press conference, the NWA did. It was kind of like almost meant like as a news report. They had like a woman who was acting like you know, a reporter on the scene, and then, you know, they had Gordon Solie, who was very respected in a wrestling announcer and, you know, quasi journalist, I guess, and, you know, some people thought he would, you know, just had that credibility anyway. And mm-hmm. It was, the idea was that it was selecting the site of the Race and Flair rematch, and they, you know, they cut to a boardroom where, you know, all the NWA promoters, or, you know, at least many of them, are sitting, and then they have Bob Geigel, the president, who's at the podium, and then he announces that it's Jim Crockett getting the match, and they have Jim Crockett, you know, announce, you know, how excited he is to have it, and, you know, you know, it was, you know, interesting, the Mid-Atlantic territory, how kind of the power balance was shifting to where, you know, Mid-Atlantic was really becoming the power center of the NWA. In fact, you know, basically became synonymous with the NWA, you know, later in the decade. And that was, you know, pretty much due to Flair, you know, I would guess. And,
yeah.
You know, and it had been, you know, St. Louis for dozens of years since the NWA had formed in the late 40s. And, you know, it was kind of Georgia for a while because they had national television, and, you know, they were really kind of a, you know, a hot deal, and then, you know, kind of shifted to Mid-Atlantic before the NWA, you know, fell apart, then never really, you know, was, you know, tremendously relevant again.
Mm-hmm.
So, anything else to, you want to mention about the buildup?
Well, I think you covered it pretty well. He said the Flair promo when he came back, and, you know, it was just so heated, and that's the great thing, and what really makes the match work is, you know, everything just obviously feels personal. You know, if you have somebody who puts a bounty out on your head and people attack you and break your neck, or
yeah,
injure your neck,
try to end your career,
you know, and that's what his try to end his career. That's what his promo said. You know, that he's been wrestling for 10 years, and this is what he loves, and you tried to take away what I love.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah. He's fighting for his honor and you know and for his title, and you know it's just a very basic story, but it's just really really you know it's something that people can relate to.
Right. There's no magic urns or coffins or lightning bolts or anything like that. It's just,
yeah, there's nothing hokey about this.
Just two guys who hate each other, and
yeah.
Do you know when they decided to have it in a steel cage?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, just obviously the reason for it was to prevent outside interference, because, you know, there had been obviously interference in their last match. I don't know if that was, you know, that was the announced the whole time, or if that was a last minute thing. I don't know. You know, whether that was really played up as a huge stipulation or not, or if it was just, I mean, I'm sure it was, because obviously they, you know, they didn't do stipulation matches that didn't at least have some meaning. So,
right.
But no, I don't know exactly at what point that was, you know, established as a cage match.
Okay.
One thing to note is that the special referee is former NWA champion Gene Kaniski, who is not afraid to get himself involved in the action here, as you'll see.
No.
Yeah. And, I mean, it really just, you know, when you see the crowd and the way that it's presented by announcers, Gordon Solie and Bob Caudle, kind of the way they discuss the strategy, it feels like a really big, you know, like a big time sporting event, you know?
Yeah.
And the crowd just really like hanging on every move and, you know, pin the 10. I just thought that it was really cool. Even when the bell signals the start of the match, like you get like a big cheer, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which
yeah.
is cool.
You know, you can obviously tell that being in Carolina that they're way behind Flair. And even when he makes his entrance and, you know, his music plays beforehand and the arena's dark, and then there's a little flash and it shows Flair and there's a big pop, and then he just walks down with no music, and you know, the crowd is just, you know, buzzing with anticipation and trying to, you know, everyone's trying to reach out and touch Flair, and it really felt, watching these entrances, this match felt more important than you know, watching modern day entrances where everybody has the same sort of entrance and there's fireworks and
yeah,
you know,
it's like
match felt special.
Yeah, they're it's almost like a sense of elegance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and or grandeur. Yeah, and you know, I like how Race just like simply walks out and he just, you know, he's drowned by a sea of booze. It's just, you know, that's perfect for his character, who you know is just a, you know, rough and tumble guy, you know, nothing fancy about him. And although he does have an immaculate robe on, which I don't remember Race really ever wearing one, but I guess like in this situation, it's kind of cool because, you know, it's like, you know, he's looking his best in a, you know, on a big stage.
Right.
So,
go
ahead.
And, like you said before, this wasn't exactly pay-per-view. Was it closed circuit?
Yes, it was closed
television.
Circuit. Yes, it was. They had closed circuit matches before, but this was, you know, one of the biggest ones. In fact, it you know, in total, if you include closed circuit, it drew, you know, 65,000 people.
Right.
Or, I'm sorry, 55,000 people, which is obviously, you know, in a city the size of Greensboro. And, you know, and there were, you know, it was a... You know, it was a national. I'm not sure how far across the nation it was shown, but it was, you know, I'm sure most of the, you know, the closer it came in the Carolinas area, you know, for a show to do 55,000 people seeing it, you know, 40,000 of them closed circuit and 15,000 in the arena. That's you know, a pretty impressive number, and you know, and you know, they were doing great. business there in, you know, in the Greensboro era for quite a while. In fact, they'd even that summer had what is even remembered as a bigger match if you're just talking about strictly the Carolinas, the Jay Youngblood and Ricky Steamboat against Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernoodle had a, you know, very long term tag team feud that was a, you know, also a really hot deal. So they just, they had a lot of big they had a lot of big programs going on, and like I said, they were, you know, they were you know, really hot. In fact, you know, wrestling all over was pretty hot in 83 in a lot of the territories, which is interesting because it's right before, you know, Vince makes his national expansion. But you know, the business in, you know, a lot of places, particularly, you know, Texas and Florida and, you know, even St. Louis, you know, there a lot of these places are really, really you know, doing great. And so, you know, talking about the match itself, I just really like you know, like every single punch and chop and elbow and kick and knee and suplex, I mean, just really, really, you know, they all look really punishing. You know, like it seems like, you know, every move they, you know, has consequences, you know, when you're talking about Race, Flair working over Race with the figure four, and then Race later, you know, trying a suplex, but not, you know, being it, but falling down because, you know, his knee gives out. Or, you know, you're talking about, you know, Flair, you know, like Race, you know, one of his main offensive weapons is a headbutt, and he just, you know, gets, you know, he hits Flair really hard with them, and then you can just kind of hear like Flair, like, you know, screaming in agony louder and louder, like on every attempt, you know, I mean, just stuff like that.
And I like how, just how the match is laid out. You know, it starts out, Flair, and they make a point of it that Flair was an amateur wrestler in high school and in college at the University of Minnesota before he became a pro, and Race has been a pro since he was 17 years old, and talked about the difference in styles a little bit. And then for the first few minutes, you have Flair controlling the match on the ground with headlocks and you know, different, you know, quote unquote amateur wrestling moves.
Yeah.
Pretty much up until Race breaks out with a souple.
Yes.
And then you have Race, you know, the more the physical, gritty person pounding on Flair. And then kind of from then on, it's not as much of a technical wrestling match as it is just a fight.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I like how Flair, like, you know, is able to like evade like some of like the key moves from Race, like a standing headbutt and an elbow drop. And like the way that Race hit, you know, the way he misses, it looks like he was going to hit him so hard that those moves would have been really damaging. So, you know, it's just kind of like, yeah, Flair, you know, using his wrestling acumen and also, you know, kind of avoiding the, you know, the big powerful stuff from, you know, from the Race, who, you know, who's a bit bigger and stronger, and, you know, and obviously he just has that reputation as a tough guy, you know,
right,
where Flair is, you know, obviously more, you know, resilient than tough. You know, in reputation.
I haven't seen the previous two matches, the one in June or the one in August, but, you know, Flair dodging the big moves, you know, it actually looked like they, you know, had scouted each other. They knew each other's, you know, tendencies, and you could sort of tell that throughout the match too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I believe, you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, obviously they wrestled those two matches, but I'm pretty sure they wrestled, you know, many times together. You know, they were,
right,
this was known as a, you know, as a long-term rivalry. You know, yeah, I you know, they eventually you know, they, and then, you know, it's kind of like later when they start to, you know, get the cage involved. And they, you know, they start slamming each other, you know, into the cage, and they, you know, both are get bloodied from slams into the cage, you know, so yeah, it just kind of builds as, you know, as the match progresses, kind of the violence gets worse and worse, and you know, they just, you know, all the cage wall slams look pretty hard, and you've got some of the key spots I would say are Race tries a second gets a second rope headbutt for two, and then hits a vertical suplex, and then Race keeps punching Flair on the ground, you know, kind of as he's been weakened from the blood loss, and then Kaniski ends up pulling Race by the hair away from Flair after he's kind of, you know, he's punching with closed fists, and you know, Flair's in the corner, and like we kind of mentioned before, Kaniski's very overly eager almost to enforce the rules, especially the no closed fists, which is kind of funny, you know, since there's no worry about closed fists in matches today. That's sort of a distinction that's almost been completely lost. And basically, several times he just, you know, he drags the other guy, you know, off the other man, you know, for these infractions. You don't usually see, you know, refs usually count. They don't usually get physically involved, but I guess that's kind of the point of having Kaniski, because he was a former wrestler, and I think he was still an active wrestler, although he's very much near the end of his career. So he was, go ahead.
There's even some parts where I think right after Race busts Flair open, and then Race is pounding Flair in the corner. Kaniski even holds Race back, and that allows Flair to punch Race. And then, less than a minute later, the opposite happens. Kaniski's holding Flair, and that allows Race to punch Flair. I guess I thought I'd heard at the beginning of the match that it was no disqualification, but I don't know.
That's probably that would probably be true. I mean, most cage matches would be no disqualification. Yeah, I guess. You kind of think that, like, there's a school of thought that even, like, in no disqualification matches, like, referees should still want it to be as clean as possible. So okay. I guess it's kind of a thing, or, you know, maybe that was just, no one really, thought of that when they were putting the match together. I guess it's possible, too. Interesting. Interesting observation there. I think you're right. Yeah, I think it would have been no disqualification. So why make a really big thing about the punches? I guess why also, why does somebody have to break when they, hit the ropes, too, which is, always funny. But, one thing I thought was interesting when, Flair gets the figure four on Race, and then, Race, turns him over, that Sully says that he's only seen that happen one time before.
Yeah.
Which, given that we've seen that 1,000 times, it's just a funny difference. So.
But even then, even then he made a point of, well, this time Race didn't even really break the figure four. He turned it over, and then Flair turned it right back over into the ropes.
Right. Yeah. And then it's exactly, yeah, then he had to, then it, like, so we, of course we had a break at this point. We were, getting to the finish, like I said, we talked about, Kaniski pulling Race by the hair, and then, Flair gets an advantage, and, then kind of the opposite happens. And then, Flair blocks a suplex and gets one of his own, but he misses an elbow drop. And then Race gets a headlock, and then he and Kaniski accidentally butt heads. And so Kaniski kind of stumbles, and then Flair goes to the top and hits a body press. And then Race kind of grazes Kaniski on the way down. And then that's when the... That's enough for the three, and then there's a big celebration as the baby faces all run into the ring, including Ricky Steamboat, and Flair's lifted on Angelo Mosca's shoulders, and they all celebrate with him in the ring, and then his then wife comes in, and then Flair kisses and hugs her, and holds the belt in the air, and I really thought that, you know, his cheerful, humble speech afterward, thanking the crowd was quite touching.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great finish. And again, you know, the celebration afterward, just showing how big of a moment it is. I'm not sure, you know, why all the baby faces would have necessarily been happy for Flair. Were they all wrestlers from the territory, so they're happy as a champion within their territory?
I think they all pretty much were within the territory, and that was just kind of a thing like that. I mean, the baby faces basically start together, and the heels start together, and they were, you know, happy when one of their own won. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, they wouldn't necessarily sometimes, you know, compete against each other, although that didn't happen a whole lot, but they were, I think it was both hometown pride and babyface pride.
Okay. And what do you think the finish, we talked about how Race sort of grazed Kaniski on the way down. I don't know. I almost felt like it really didn't need the ref bump, and he really didn't trip over Kaniski enough to have any effect.
Yeah, the end seems kind of, I mean, it, you know, in the scheme of things, it was hardly a big thing, but yeah, it did seem a little, it certainly seemed a little off.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I like the end that it, I think one thing that modern wrestling gets into a lot is that, you know, the, John Cena has to hit the attitude adjustment or the lock in the STF, and that's the only way he wins. Or Randy Orton has to hit the RKO, and that's the only way he wins. There's not,
you gotta hit a finishing move. There's not really multiple ways to win a match. You know, there's
right.
You know, one or two, maybe if you have a submission move too. I've talked about that before, but that's definitely, I always think it's better to have multiple ways to win a match, just because, you know, it makes you feel like the match finish can come out of nowhere rather than, you know, off of, you know, either a finisher or, you know, some sort of weapon shot or something like that.
Right. That's one thing where I think maybe comparing this match to, you know, UFC is if you watch MMA at all, then, you know, really any punch can end the match. And here, they fought for 20 minutes. They were both worn out. And Flair hit a move. And really, I guess there wasn't a whole lot of high flying in the match. I mean, neither of these guys are big high flyers. But
yeah,
Flair hit a big move, even if it wasn't his signature move, and wins the match with it.
Definitely. Yeah, one thing I think is interesting is how little like the traditional Flair match this feels like. You know, I mean, it's a great match. It's one of his greatest matches, but it doesn't really, you know, there aren't a lot of the signature Flair spots that we've come, you know, that we kind of come to expect to see from him over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a tremendous number of Race matches, but it kind of feels more like, you know, Race's match, you know, the style of match almost, it feels like his style of match anyway.
Right. And I think that might have even been part of the story. Like, Flair tried to wrestle his way, that didn't work, and then so he, you know, wrestled, you know,
yes, very much.
Race,
yeah.
Style and was able to beat Race wrestling his style.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, any more thoughts on the match?
I don't think so. It's one of my, you know, before I got the Essential Starcade collection, I think sometime last year, and this was easily my favorite match the first time I watched it through. This time, I was a little bit more bugged by the Kaniski involvement, just because I thought he got in there maybe too much. But it's still, a great match. I don't think it really took away from anything. It's not like he cost Race the match or anything like that. He was, you know, at least it was fair down the middle. whoever was punching with a closed fist, he'd grab that person and drag him away.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you know, it kind of went with both sides. And I guess it, you know, kind of gave Race, you know, an out a little bit to, you know, build the rematches or whatever, you know. But yeah, I mean, yeah, other than the, you know, slight issues with that, I think, you know, it's basically almost a perfect match. And it's, you know, it's something, you know, I don't think, you know, anyone watching it today would be, you know, would be bored by it. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's something that, you know, holds up today. I think, I really think, you know, there's kind of the idea that, like, you know, wrestling is something, you know, great wrestling, you know, depends on, like, the context of territory and time. But I think, you know, I think truly great matches can, you know, really work in, you know, just about any era. And I think, you know, I think a fan who hasn't seen a whole lot of classic stuff watching this, I think, you know, 95% of them would, you know, would think this is great and would really, you know, would really be into it. So it's definitely, definitely worth checking out, both for historical value and, you know, for pure enjoyment's sake.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that sounds like it for that. Thanks a lot, everybody, for listening. And check us out. We've got we've moved to a new site, WrestleSpective.com. You can check us out there. We've got all of our podcasts up there, and, you know, some new blogs to for everyone to enjoy. And we got a special power pole page as well, if you're into the power pole. And we got plenty more exciting things coming along with that. And you can also find us twitter.com/wrestlespective or facebook.com/wrestlespective. Good ways to check out those pages and leave us a comment or just, you know, tell us how we did, or, you know, what we do well or what we don't do well, or any ideas you have for stuff we can talk about. And also, we're available by email at WrestleSpective@gmail.com. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you again.